MacCast, Sunday, April 20th, 2014. Hey, Mac Geeks, it's time for your MacCast, the show for Mac Geeks by Mac Geeks. I'm Adam, and this is the show where we discuss all things Macintosh. How you doing? Welcome back to the MacCast. Well, it has been quite a past week or so for me. You ever have one of those weeks, I guess it might be? I have them from time to time where just everything seems to go all sideways on you, and you're left scrambling and wondering what to do. I won't give you a lot of details, but needless to say, you know, we had taxes, and then I had some car trouble and all sorts of stuff. But that leads me to the good part of my week, which is when I get to sit down and talk to you about Mac and Apple stuff. And boy, do we have a lot of stuff to talk about. We're going to get into some of the aftermath of Heartbleed a little bit. We haven't talked about that. And I just want to give you my take on some of the stuff that's been going on and give you some information that I think hasn't been really spread around. We've got, of course, a lot of Mac Apple rumors to talk about, iPhones and iWatches and a whole bunch more stuff. Some exciting news, at least as far as I'm concerned, with regards to CarPlay. And Yahoo wants to be your search engine, at least on iOS. So we're going to talk about all that in the news. And then I am, being that it's Easter and everything, I'm going to take you on some trips down some rabbit holes. Because along with all the stuff I was going through this week, and including some computer troubles, I was able to follow some paths and go down some rabbit holes. And actually in a good way. You know, sometimes going down rabbit holes can get us lost and in the dark. But this time around, it actually worked out, and I got some great content for the show. So we're going to talk about file formats and iWork, and also some fixes and things that I ran across during my trials and tribulations over the last week or so. So lots of good stuff to get into in this episode. But before we get started, I do want to take a quick moment and thank one of my show sponsors, and that is Sanebox. You know, if you're like me, you get a ton of email, probably too much email, and your inbox is completely overflowing, and it can drive you crazy. You sign up for things, you get on lists, and suddenly there's all this stuff in there, and it's all intermixed and mingled up with the important emails, the stuff that you need to get to. In my case, that's emails from you, and it's all jumbled up, hard to find. Sanebox takes care of that, because what it does is it declutters your inbox. It's a service, and it moves all of those less important emails. Not that they're unimportant, a lot of those things I want to get, but it moves those less important emails off into separate folders automatically, and then summarizes everything for you in a digest email. And it says, hey, we moved this stuff over here. When you're ready to deal with it and take a look at it, go ahead. And for everything else, we've left it in your inbox, and you only end up with the important emails in your inbox, the stuff that you need to reply to right away. So what's really cool about it is you sign up for the service and it works everywhere. It works on any email provider, any client, any device that you have. You'll simply see these extra folders that Sanebox creates, and it'll be things like Sane Later. Hey, these are emails that we think you're going to want to get to later. And as far as training it goes, it could not be easier, because once you sign up and you set up the boxes and the folders that you want, all you have to do is move the appropriate items into the folders. So my training consisted of taking stuff from one folder, moving it into another folder, saying, nope, that's bulk mail. No, these are newsletter emails. No, these are things that I want in my inbox. And after a week or so, it was just automatic. And now my inbox is completely decluttered. I see just the messages that I want. Occasionally something will slide in there and I just move it to the other folder. And Sanebox is always watching, training itself. And so how does it know what's important? It uses all your past behavior to kind of figure out what's going on. So what emails do you open? What do you respond to? How quickly do you respond to those? How often do you respond to them? So it'll see that, hey, you reply to these people all the time. They should probably stay in your inbox. These other things you don't open for 4 or 5 days. Those are probably less important. Those can go into the later folder. And they add new features. Like just this week, I saw that they added a Sane Not Spam folder. How often does this happen to you, where something goes into your spam folder and it's not really spam? Sanebox can figure that stuff out now too and put it into a not spam folder, So you can go look in there and say, oh, yep, that's really not spam. Or yes, this is. So it's not going to get buried down somewhere where you're not going to find it. It's going to be right there in that not spam folder. And they have a ton of other features, including one click unsubscribing. You can snooze emails. So if you want to get an email out of your inbox, but you just want it to come back a day later or a week later, you can do that sort of thing. You can even set up custom time frames. It can move attachments, large files, automatically to your Dropbox, so you're not eating up all the storage on your email. Lots of really cool stuff and features. You really should check it out. Sanebox, and you can get a free trial and a $10 credit because you're a Maccast listener. Just go to sanebox.com/Maccast. You're going to get a $10 credit. You can try it for free, see how cool it really is. I got hooked on it. Dave Sparks had told me about it. I held off on doing it. Now I can't live without it. Sanebox.com/Maccast. Check it out. And a big thank you to them for their support of the Maccast. Now, I know you're probably sick of hearing about Heartbleed. It's been in the news for the past couple weeks in the tech community. It's been one of the big, big stories. And me too. I'm kind of a little bit tired of hearing about it. But the thing is a lot of the news reports, all they're talking about is how scary this thing is and how serious this thing is. And SSLs and, you know, OpenSSL's in trouble. And this is a big, big issue. And you need to change your passwords. But nobody's really going into what I consider this story that we need to know more about, which is the why is this thing such a big deal and what do we need to do about it? Well, fortunately for us, my buddy Jeff Gamet over at the Mac Observer has been doing a great job of actually breaking the whole thing down. He wrote a great piece over there, an awesome article. I recommend you read it to get all of the details, but I'm going to give you some highlights. So there'll be a link to the article in the show notes at maccast.com, but I'm going to give you just the rundown of what is Heartbleed, why do we need to be concerned about it, and what are some of the things we can do to kind of deal with it and keep ourselves protected. And it's pretty straightforward, but again, no one's talking about this stuff. I always want to know why, you know, what's going on under the hood, what caused this to happen. And so what Heartbleed is, if you haven't heard about it, and I don't know how you could not have heard about it by this point, but it's an exploit of a security flaw in OpenSSL. Now, most of us know SSL or secure socket layer, as that little lock that pops up in your browser, right? When you're on your banking website or you're going to a site where you need to log into something. It's the thing that secures and protects and encrypts the traffic between our web browser and whatever web server we're connecting to. It also makes it so that we know, hey, yeah, we are connected to apple.com or maccast.com or Amazon.com, and we feel safe when that little lock is on. Well, OpenSSL is an open source implementation of the SSL and the newer TLS or Transport Layer Security protocols, and it's used by many websites because it's open source. It's used by a lot of websites, but not all websites. And so that's where some of the concern came through, because I think I heard something like 60% of the websites on the internet were using OpenSSL, something like that. And so that's a lot of websites. So this is a big deal. It was right for them to kind of make a big deal about it. And what the Heartbleed exploit takes advantage of is a flaw in a version of the OpenSSL code. And it's a flaw that can be used to trick the server into handing over its private encryption keys. And that's a big deal, because anyone with a private encryption key from the server can then get access to that encrypted traffic. So they can then see that private data flowing back and forth. So that could be usernames and passwords, that could be your credit card information, all that sort of stuff that normally needs to be protected. And the flaw is in OpenSSL's heartbeat function, which is this function that keeps the SSL TLS sessions open with a server instead of timing out. So it forces you to not have to constantly be logging back in and starting over with your connection. So once it sets up that secure connection, it's designed to keep it open using this little heartbeat function of the OpenSSL technology. Well, the flaw in the OpenSSL code was that if a browser were to send a heartbeat request that didn't include as much data as it should, then the server would respond by handing over random bits of data stored in memory, 64K at a time. So if you kept exploiting this enough, you could end up with enough extra data to rebuild these encryption keys. And that's where the name Heartbleed comes from, because it's an exploit of this heartbeat thing that is going on in OpenSSL. And so the code bug that makes Heartbleed possible was actually introduced into OpenSSL in March of 2012, and it wasn't patched until April 7th of this year. So it was open for about 2 years and exploitable. And the big fix that needs to happen is that owners of sites that have unpatched versions of OpenSSL need to update their servers. They also need to reissue all of those SSL certificates. They have to revoke the ones that are existing now in case they were exploited. And nobody knows exactly how many of these were exploited, because unfortunately with this hack too, it's pretty much untraceable. It's very hard to detect if you've been exploited by this thing, because it's just normal heartbeat traffic. It doesn't appear that anything's out of the ordinary. So they're going to have to revoke certificates, they're going to have to reissue them, and this whole process is going to take time. But again, this is only for servers that were using OpenSSL, and that's not everything on the internet, and it's only for servers that weren't patched. So there's really no way of knowing if a site or service that you use is impacted. So what does that mean? How do we protect ourselves? Oh, and it's very important to point out that Apple's technologies, Apple's servers, iTunes, all those things, because Apple uses SSL technology. They don't use OpenSSL, though. They use their own stuff. So OS X, iOS, your iCloud applications, all those things aren't impacted. Now, that's not to say other apps and websites and services that you use from your Mac. So if you're connecting to a web server on Safari, or if you're connecting from a third-party app and it has implemented OpenSSL, there could be vulnerabilities there. But Apple's technology, the first-party technology that Apple has, is not affected by this bug. But there's really no way of knowing exactly who was impacted. I think Yahoo had some issues, some other big sites. But I know, I double-checked, I think, on Amazon, and a lot of the services that I use weren't impacted. I don't think Gmail was impacted, all those sorts of things. So what you want to do is, one, try and figure out, hey, am I using a service that was impacted by the bug? And you could do that by emailing the site host. A lot of sites and services are being proactive, and they're sending out emails to their customers letting them know. There are also some lists online that you can check, so you can do a little Googling around and searching. And if you are aware that a site or a service that you're accessing isn't vulnerable, then you really don't want to probably use that service until they've been patched up. And then once they are patched up, you're probably going to want to go in and change your username and password. I would normally say change your username and password immediately, but if they are open and potentially vulnerable, obviously that traffic could be being intercepted or could be being exploited. So it might not do you a lot of benefit until they actually get their systems patched up. And then once they are patched up, you want to make sure that you do go in and change your username and passwords there. You should also make sure that you're using different usernames and passwords on every site that you register for. So use a thing like LastPass or 1Password. I'm a big 1Password fan. And you probably, if you've been using the same username and password all over the internet, now's a really good time to probably set up different ones. Because again, you're not going to know which sites may potentially have been exploited. So if you were using the same credentials everywhere, there could be one site that exposed that information, and you're going to want to make sure that you close that back up. Another thing that you want to do is you want to make sure that your Mac is going to recognize those revoked certificates. So like I said, on the provider end, they're going to have to pull their old certificates, and you're going to want to be aware and notified when that happens so that you can get the new certificate, and again, that you can change your credentials with that service. So you want to double check if you're using Safari, go into applications, or if you're using Safari as your main web browser, and also all of the other services that you might connect to from Apple with SSL, so Mail, things like that, you can go into Keychain Access, open up Applications Utilities, Keychain Access, launch that, and then go into the Keychain Access menu, choose Preferences, and then click on the Certificates tab. And then in that tab, you're going to want to make sure that you set the online certificate status protocol and certificate revocation list to both be set to best attempt and then set priority to OCSP. And I went in to double check mine after reading Jeff's article because he pointed this out in that. And that's what mine was set to. And I don't think I've ever changed mine. So I think those are probably the defaults. But you want to make sure that those are set to that. And then that will, what that will do is it will tell every application that relies on your Mac's built-in keychain to avoid any of these revoked certificates. So that would include Safari and Mail and a lot of other applications. For other browsers, Chrome, Firefox, go check out Jeff's article. I don't want to take the time to get into all of them, but you can also set that up to be notified and made aware of the sites that revoke the certificates. So that's what's going on with Heartbleed. That's what it is in a nutshell. Again, I didn't get into a lot of the details, but you can check out Jeff's article for a lot more information. But hopefully that kind of just explains things and maybe waylays at least some of the fear-mongering that's going on around there. I mean, this is serious. I don't want to downplay it at all. But again, if you're doing the things that we always talk about with security, using different username and passwords, using long, secure passwords, things like that, you should be able to better manage and sort of mitigate your risks, even with this sort of pretty big exploit. So if you have any questions, additional questions about this stuff, I'm happy to look into anything. You can shoot me an email, maccast@gmail.com. Let's get into some of the latest things going on with iPhone 6, the next generation iPhone, and rumors there. Reports continue to be pouring in that we're going to see a 4.7-inch version of the iPhone 6, sometime in the fall. We've also had rumors of a larger screen version, possibly a 5.5-inch. That seems to be the most popular rumor. And a lot of the sources are saying that's not going to come until later in the year. So that Apple will bring out the first one in the fall and then sort of the larger, higher-end version later before the end of the year. It's something that's being echoed over and over again. But in my mind, repeating something over and over again doesn't always make it true. I kind of tend to defer to logic and common sense and also past behavior. And I think that Apple typically is not going to do one. They're not going to do two different versions of the same device. So if they're going to put out an iPhone 6 this year, they're going to put out one iPhone 6, same form factor across the board. And I also think that to put out another version really late in the year, you're going to miss the holiday buying season. I just don't see the logic for it. But a lot of people are saying that that's what's going on. As far as the larger screen, you know that I'm not overly thrilled of Apple doing a larger screen phone. I'm pretty happy with the size of my iPhone 5S. I could see going up to about 4.7 to 5 inches, somewhere in that range. I'll live with it. But I also recognize that I'm very much in the minority. ChangeWave over the past week said that about 40% of near-term iPhone buyers say they want a larger screen. And I've heard from a number of you that you really want a larger screen as well. So I think that's just the trend in cell phones and smartphones, that more people want the bigger screens. I think there is a point where the size becomes ridiculous. When we're getting into these 6-inch phones, they're getting pretty close to a 7-inch tablet. And at that point, I think we're kind of blurring the lines. Is it a phone? Is it a tablet? Exactly what is it? It's a gigantophone, and I really don't want one of those. But there have been, of course, now images, case images, tooling images, also an alleged front panel from a next generation iPhone 6 showed up on a Chinese website. I think Weibo was it. What was interesting about that is they did some analysis because they had it side by side with like an iPhone 5S. And if you look at the images and look at the size ratios, it seems like that shows a 5.1-inch display with a 16:9 aspect ratio. And we have heard nothing about that size screen in any of the Apple rumors. But when you think about it, that size makes more sense in some ways than a 4.7 or a 5.5-inch, because it's the same, and that aspect ratio as well, same aspect ratio as the iPhone 4, and it could use a pure 1080p resolution screen, so 1920 by 1080, and that would make everything kind of translate and match up. But again, it doesn't jive with any of the other rumors, so I'm not putting a lot of stock in it. But that might also be as I was thinking about it, that would be a nice compromise between the 4.7 and the 5.5 if Apple were to bring out just one screen size. Kind of falls right in the middle there. So something's feeling really nice about a 5.1-inch screen to me, but I still don't think that's going to happen. I think we're going to get a 4.7-inch, and that seems to be what KGI analyst Ming-Chi Kuo is saying as well. And he came out this past week. We're going to be talking about him a lot in this episode. And he's a worthy source to talk about because he is very often right on these Apple rumors. So he's saying there's going to be a 4.7-inch screen. It's going to be at 1334 by 750 pixels on the screen resolution. That's about a 326 pixel per inch density. So that falls in the Retina range. And then also a 5.5-inch screen running at the 1920 by 1080. That's the 1080p resolution. That would be 401 pixels per inch. I think the 4.7 is falling a little short on the pixel density compared to some of the other smartphones that are now out on the market. I think Apple has to step up the pixel density game in numbers, even though it doesn't matter. It's just that consumers generally don't recognize that. You and I know that that's just silly, but hey. And also, I think that 1920 by 1080 is going to be an easier translation for developers. They can kind of lock in on that screen resolution, and that gives Apple some room to grow if they want to get the screen sizes bigger and move things around. It's going to be a little bit of work up front for developers to kind of retool for the new resolution, but they've done that in the past. It's not something that we haven't gone through before, and I think we can manage it. We've managed it before. Might have to do some letterboxing stuff on older applications, all those sorts of things, but that's going to be fine. They're also saying, or Chai Kuo is also saying, an A8 processor, 1 gigabyte of RAM, which is interesting because, again, a lot of Apple's competitors are upping the RAM, but so far, the iPhone hasn't seemed to need more RAM. We've been managing it pretty well. We're doing some pretty impressive and amazing things, I think, because of the GPU technologies and stuff that are like that are in there. Also, the coprocessors. So that doesn't concern me too much. An LTPS display panel, optical image stabilization on the camera. So a nice little update inside the camera, although most rumors I've heard are saying we're not going to get more pixel resolution. So again, sticking with an 8-megapixel sensor, I'd like to see Apple up that a little bit more. Again, just to play around in the numbers game, knowing full well that really image quality is what it's going to come down to. But Apple's competitors are catching up in terms of some of the camera technologies. I've been seeing some good reports and hearing good things about the latest Galaxy phones in terms of the camera. And then, of course, Touch ID in there. A 10 to 20% narrower bezel, which will help with the form factor, the overall size of the device. So going to a larger screen and reducing that bezel is going to keep it in a nice pocketable form factor. As a matter of fact, I think Ming-Chi Kuo said the 4.7-inch version is still going to be usable with one hand because it's going to be much narrower and much thinner, 6.5 to 7 millimeters thin, which is going to be a pretty thin device. As a matter of fact, I think some of the reports are saying that the camera lens, because just the physical dimensions, the physical thinness is actually going to stick out just a little bit. It doesn't look like from some of the leaked images that we're seeing that it's going to be as much as we saw on, say, like the iPod Touch. But, you know, you're going to have kind of that little camera bump on the back that a lot of smartphones have these days. Another interesting rumor is that the sleep-wake button, which has always been on the top of our phones, is actually going to get moved over to the side. I don't know if I care too much about that, but it is interesting. It's going to be a significant design change. The one thing Chai Kuo put in his iPhone 6 rumors that I'm just not buying into is NFC integration, near-field communication. I don't think Apple has any need for that or any reason to put that into the phone. We don't do the bump thing. We've got AirDrop, which works great over Wi-Fi. We've got Bluetooth technologies. I don't think Apple's building a payment system built on NFC. So there are some rumors. Again, I think these are from Chai Kuo that NFC would also be in the upcoming iWatch. So maybe there's some sort of NFC integration for the iWatch band. That could be the only reason I would see for throwing it in there, but I just don't, it doesn't make any sense to me. It seems totally superfluous in terms of a feature. And then he's also saying that the 5.5-inch version is the only one that's going to use a sapphire display. Now, that kind of goes against some of the other rumors that we've been hearing that Apple is going to do sapphire displays in all of the iPhones moving forward. That's why we've got that big glass plant going into production in Arizona that Apple helped fund. But we'll have to wait and see on that one. But Chaiquo says only the 64-gigabyte 5.5-inch model. And I have a question. Would you pay more for the next generation iPhone? That rumor came out this week. Jefferies analyst Peter Misick is saying that Apple has been kind of poking around at the carriers about a $100 price hike on the iPhone 6. So would you pay $100 more? That's, again, something that's not typically in Apple's nature. They tend to bring out new phones and kind of keep the pricing structure the same. Another $100... we're probably going to suck it up and pay it, and I think that's why Apple's going after it. They're realizing that there is a really high demand for a larger screen iPhone, and that early adopters are likely going to be willing to pay that extra price premium, and that means more money for Apple's bottom line. Do I want to see them do it? Am I happy about them charging another $100 on the iPhone? No, I really don't want to pay more for my iPhone, but at the same time, I know I'm probably going to do it, and a lot of us probably will, right? So, Apple makes more money. It's that whole money versus what we want sort of thing. And Apple looks out for both sides of its consumers, as much as a lot of people like to say they're always out for just us consumers. I think very often decisions are made that better Apple's bottom line. And I think that's good for all of us in the long run, especially good for the stockholders. Couple other things that we're hearing from Ming-Chi Kuo, that there's going to be updated iPad Airs and Minis. He's saying that the Air is going to get updated with an A8 processor. Apple's going to add in Touch ID technology and update the camera to an 8-megapixel camera. I think those are all pretty safe predictions, very likely to happen. I'm definitely convinced that Touch ID is going to be across the board this year on all of Apple's updates. And so to that end, he's saying that the Mini is going to pretty much stay the same as the current Retina Mini. They're going to bump up the processor to A8 and add Touch ID. And then the last thing is that we're not going to see that rumored 12.9-inch iPad Pro this year. And I think that rumor has been pretty much laid to rest, at least for 2014, something that Apple's been playing around with, but maybe they aren't quite ready to launch yet. So that's all the latest I have for you on the iPhone 6 and some of the new iPad updates. Now let's talk a little bit about iWatch, latest iWatch rumors. And I think at this point, it's safe to say it's definitely going to be some sort of device that's going to have a big health and fitness band style component. So that's kind of a hot trending thing. These little wearable devices, bands, things like the Fitbit, that lock in and have all kinds of sensors and give us health and fitness data. I think Apple's going to expand that a little bit more too and throw some more sensor functionality in there. I think they're going to go crazy with the sensors in that device. But again, KGI analyst Ming-Chi Kuo says that it's going to be a device that's going to be able to operate independently from your iPhone or iPad. I think that is a key feature. Talked a lot with John Martellaro from Mac Observer about that. He's was sort of the same mind, that it needs to have functionality that exists separate from an iOS device, but then is enhanced when you do have another Apple product, be it iPod Touch or an iPhone, something like that, or an iPad. And that seems to be what Chai Kuo is thinking as well, that it's going to offer other features and functionality that are iOS exclusive, tied more into the software and the apps, things like health monitoring apps. And we've seen those kind of cool screenshots about the HealthBook app that looks a little bit like Passbook and has all of your monitoring information and can keep track of things like heartbeats and your steps and all those sorts of things. So I think there's going to be a really tight integration if you are an iOS owner, but Apple's going to want to sell these things to non-iOS customers and people who don't already have iPhone devices. And I think it could be something that could ultimately have a really nice halo effect and push people into wanting an iPhone so that it better integrates with their iWatch. And as far as display, he's saying there's going to be two different sizes, 1.3 to 1.5 inch flexible AMOLED display with a sapphire cover. I think, again, it's going to be one form factor, one design. But ChaiQuo is saying there's going to actually be a lot of different options. Also offering a system in package design along with that NFC that he seems to be so hot on. As far as battery, they're saying 200 to 250 milliamp hour cell, and it's expected to hit at least 1 day of battery life. I would maintain that it has to do better than that. There's no way they can put a device out that's going to have anywhere near less than 1 day, and it really needs to have more than 1 day. You have to be able to put that thing on in the morning and have it last at least for a 24-hour period. It should be able to, in my mind, last a few days. I know that may not be possible. Again, if they're throwing a lot of sensor technology in there, that's going to be hard to achieve and in such a small form factor. The case and band, he's saying, are going to come in a variety of materials and designs and options, and that a version will top out in the several $1,000 price range. That's another thing where we're hearing some conflicting rumors. ChaiQuo saying this is going to be a high-end product. I've seen other sites reporting that it could start as low as $250. I don't see Apple doing this sort of this whole range of sort of designs and price points. But at the same time, we've also seen them investing and hiring on a lot of fashion designers and people like that. So it could be some sort of whole lineup where, depending on the kinds of materials, so the technology inside stays very similar, but if you want a really high-end gold one with diamonds and all kinds of extras, there might be options for that, all the way down to maybe more a more modest plastic version that's more in that $250 range. But it's definitely going to be a premium, I think, over some of the other watch wearables that we're seeing out on the market. I expect it to start somewhere in that $200 to $400 price range and go up from there. I think it's going to be pricier than maybe some of the other things like the Galaxy Gear and some of the other devices we've seen out on the market. But only time's going to tell on that one. And then late in the week, an interesting report, Nike, it's being rumored, is getting set to get rid of their hardware business in terms of the Nike Fuel Band. They're supposedly letting go all of their hardware people, and they're going to be focusing solely on software. And I think that is a brilliant move, and I think the timing seems too coincidental and too interesting. I think that Apple's worked closely with Nike in the past, and this could mean that Apple is going to have Nike doing some of the software integration with the new iWatch. I think there could be like an exclusive deal. Ultimately, I think Nike's going to want to be on all the different platforms, but they might be doing some special stuff with Apple for the iWatch launch and realizing that that's where they're going to make their money, is selling these software applications into all of these other, not just watch devices, but also other wearables and stuff like that, that they can make a lot more money selling their technology to multiple vendors, kind of going that Microsoft route. And I think that's probably a smart move on their part for the long run. As far as release date for an iWatch, we're hearing fall, sometime in that time range, alongside or near and around the iPhone 6 launch. We do keep hearing rumors of parts and suppliers being lined up for production, so that does seem to be happening right now. And as a matter of fact, overall for the fall, I'm going to say grab your barf bag and your wallet, start saving your pennies away, because the fall is going to be another one of these giant Apple product puke fests. That's kind of been my new term for what Apple does. They build up, and then we just get all of our products at once right in the fall, right before the holiday buying season. And then my bank account is completely devastated, and I have to go into the poorhouse, and nobody gets any Christmas presents because I have nothing left. But anyway, as far as the products that are coming out, I think we mentioned a few of them here. New iPad Airs, new iPad Minis, the iWatch in two sizes, an all-new 4.7-inch iPhone, an all-new 12-inch MacBook, MacBook Air, and an update to the MacBook Pro line. Oh, and just for good measure, let's toss in an Apple TV upgrade, because you know what? Come on, it's wafer thin. You can handle one more product, right? Just one more. Wafer thin, that Apple TV. But it is going to be a Apple product fest if the analysts are to be believed. And let me give you a few final details on some of those last items. A 12-inch MacBook Air, Chai Kuo is saying it's going to be fanless and have a buttonless trackpad. I couldn't figure out what that meant because, as far as I know, my trackpad doesn't have any physical buttons, but it does have buttons. I guess maybe it just means it's not going to have those clicky things, that it's just going to be purely touch enabled, but without any kind of physical click. I don't know if that's a big deal or not. I don't know if people really care about that. The Apple TV, as far as that update goes, he's saying it's going to have an app store and motion controls. Apple finally implementing some of that motion technology they got when they acquired PrimeSense. And some people are saying that's going to be so that you can control the TV without any kind of remote. I really think it's going to be more about a gaming system. I think it's going to tie in with the apps that Apple is going to bring out on the Apple TV and allow you to do more gaming style stuff, maybe artsy kind of stuff on your TV. But that remains to be seen. I just don't see myself wanting to raise and lower the volume by sort of waving my hands around in the living room, but maybe that's just me. And then something else very interesting that might be the next thing that we see from Apple, they're saying a lower cost iMac by the end of this quarter. And I think that would be a good thing, maybe help bump up Mac sales. PC sales have been on the decline in general as more and more people pick up tablets and those are kind of getting them by. So it'd be nice for Apple to have sort of a lower price point desktop model in the lineup. And don't have a lot of details on what the specs or what they're going to change in the iMac, but that should be coming very soon as well. So stay tuned for all of that. But that's the latest rumors with iWatch and new Apple products. So one of the stories that happened over the past week that I was very excited about was something that was only sort of hinted at when Apple had their CarPlay event, and that was being able to get CarPlay in aftermarket options. So if you already have a car, you don't want to maybe buy a whole new car, you don't have that in your budget just to get CarPlay functionality, are we going to be able to get that? And it's looking like we are, because Pioneer and Alpine this week announced that they are going to be putting out systems with Apple's CarPlay. So you'll be able to go out, buy a Pioneer or an Alpine system and integrate that into your existing car and get Apple CarPlay technology. So I'm very excited about that. Actually, they were both added to Apple's CarPlay website, so it is really official. The Alpine systems are reported to be starting at a cost between $500 and $700 US. Pioneer is going to start at $700 US and go up. So the systems aren't cheap, but heck of a lot cheaper than a whole brand new car, right? So if you want to get it, I don't know if I'll pick one up at this price, but I would imagine, you know, if Alpine and Pioneer are doing it, we're going to see other people jumping on board with aftermarket systems. And as more competition comes out and as the technology progresses, obviously those prices are going to be coming down. At launch, Apple did announce CarPlay support in the Mercedes, Ferrari, and the Volvo for 2014. I think Honda and Hyundai have also been added with models coming out in 2014 with CarPlay, and then there's a bunch of other vendors, car manufacturers that are on board for the future. So I would expect CarPlay to get rolled out quicker and quicker and quicker. But even those aftermarket systems are going to have the Siri integration, they're going to have the Maps integration, all the music integration, those sorts of things. So that's very, very exciting to see, and again, a lot cheaper than a brand new car. So I was excited to see that announcement. I don't know I'd be curious, how do you feel about it? Would you spend $500 to $700 to get CarPlay in your existing car? I'm kind of on the fence about it. It's a little pricey for me, and I'm getting by with just using my iPhone connected in through my auxiliary jack on my stereo, and that's done fine for me. I got Maps and Siri and my music, and I can play all that sort of stuff. So it's not as integrated, it's not as slick as CarPlay, but with that extra price tag, I don't know if I can really justify the cost. And then finally, in the news for this week, Marissa Mayer, she has been over there at Yahoo as the CEO, and I think she's really doing a great job of kind of turning Yahoo around. I was a big fan of the what did Google call their personal homepage? Google. See, I can't even remember now. I had the Google homepage, iGoogle or whatever it was, as my start page for my browser. And when they shut that down, I ended up going back over to Yahoo. And I actually really like the Yahoo page. Their news section is really beefed up. They're doing a good job with that. It integrates with my Yahoo mail. Not only that, they allowed me to integrate with my Gmail so I can get to see what's going on with my Gmail and easily pop over and check in on that stuff. So I think they're really opening it up. I think they're doing some interesting things. Hopefully they'll rescue some of that technology that they bought before Mayer came on and redo things. They're doing some interesting things with Flickr. I know it's been kind of debated. Some people like it. Some people really, really hate it. But at least they're doing stuff, right? And this time around, what we're hearing is Mayer wants to convince Apple to change the default search engine in iOS from Google to a Yahoo solution. And Siri right now, if you use Siri to do searching, it's using Bing, and Yahoo searches or Yahoo data for things like, I think, the stocks and the weather, those sorts of things. But the actual search is Bing, and Yahoo's own search is actually powered by Bing. So if you go to yahoo.com and do a search, it's actually doing a search using Bing technology. And that was the whole thing that they did with Google. But given Apple's history with Google, at first glance, when I heard this report, I thought, you know what, it doesn't seem totally crazy. Google kind of owns search, and I think people equate Google with search. And so ultimately, I don't think it's going to happen as much as Mayer might want Apple to switch the iOS search engine, but it is an interesting thing to think about. And the more I thought about it, I thought, you know what, do we really care anymore where our search actually comes from? And do people even really think about it all that much? I know people say, oh, I Googled it, but really that's just a generic term, right, for I searched for it on the internet. And I think about the fact that I'm using Siri a lot and I'm getting these results back from Siri, and that's how I really think about it. It's like, well, Siri's giving me the web search result, or Siri's giving me that information, and I don't really care that it came from Bing or Yahoo or Google. I'm not really thinking about that stuff that's going on behind the scenes. So I think search is getting more and more obfuscated from what we're actually doing, right? So if you're searching in an app, that search could be coming from anywhere, but you're interacting with that app. Or if you're searching on your device, that information could be coming from anywhere. As long as the information is accurate and comes back in a timely fashion, I'm not so sure that it's going to really matter in the long term. And that could be sort of what Mayer and Yahoo are thinking about here. And I don't think Apple, even if they went forward with something like this, they would give exclusive access to Yahoo. It would just be, hey, we'll make you the default so that when I fire up Safari on iOS, the default search is Yahoo, but I could always change it if I really wanted to in the settings. So it really might not be that big of a deal to a lot of people. And it could come down to the revenue. You know, how much is Yahoo willing to give Apple to get that default search spot? It's been rumored that Google pays a lot for that functionality. So this would be another area where it would be very hard for Yahoo to wrest that control or get that control from Google. But if they could make it happen, that would be a really, really big deal. The other thing is that when Yahoo did the deal with Microsoft, they have to use Microsoft technology, or it's my understanding they have to use Microsoft Bing technology to power their search on Yahoo.com. But that agreement does not extend into mobile and contextual searches. So that's why the information for, say, Yahoo for weather on iOS can come from Yahoo Weather. It doesn't have to come from Bing. So this may be Yahoo's play to kind of get back into the search game using Apple and mobile. And once again, if that business deal is lucrative enough, it might be crazier for Apple not to jump in and take advantage of what Yahoo wants to offer. So again, something interesting to think about long term, or at least in the short term, rather. I don't think Apple's going to be switching away. I don't think we'll be seeing that happen this year, but the wheels might be set in motion for kind of shake up and search. And it could ultimately mean good things for Yahoo, but also I think good things for Apple and us, because Yahoo might be willing to do a lot more for Apple than, say, Google is. You know, Apple doesn't have a lot of pull with Google, and they could have a lot of pull with Yahoo in terms of shaping and forming the technology. And I really do think that integrated, contextual, predictive search stuff is going to be really, really important. And if Apple doesn't want to build that from the ground up, they could leverage Yahoo to help them sort of achieve those goals. So with that, I think that is going to do it for the news for this week. Before we move on, I do want to take a quick moment and thank another one of my show sponsors, and that is Smile. And today, you know, Smile has a ton of great products, and you should check them all out. But today I want to talk to you about PDF Pen for iPad. And I really do think it is the best way to view, manage, edit, annotate, and work with PDFs on the iPad, also on the Mac, but we're going to talk about the iPad today. You know, and we just had, I mentioned earlier, we had taxes. I had tax time, not my favorite time of year, but during that time of year, I do rely heavily on PDF Pen to get all of my documents and information ready for doing my taxes. And I especially use it to fill out a lot of PDF, what I call fake forms. These are the forms, they look like they have form fields, right? You got lines and it says name here, first name, last name, all the boxes and stuff like that, but they're not actually coded up to be clickable or editable. Well, I can go into PDF Pen and I can add in text, I can add in my boxes, and I can do that on my Mac and I can put all that information in. On the iPad, I can add in boxes and I can fill those sorts of things in. I can take notes. I can make annotations. So if I need to make an annotation for my tax person, hey, you need to look into this or check out here, I can do that. If I need to add signatures and sign documents, I can do that right on my iPad. So if something comes into email, send the PDF over to PDF Pen, add in my signature, send it back out on email. They make that really seamless and easy. And PDF Pen for iPad has been updated for iOS 7. Note that it does now require iOS 7 to use PDF Pen, but it's been fully updated for iOS 7, has significant improvements in performance as well as a number of bug fixes. And one of the features I really like about it is that it syncs. Importing and exporting, getting things in and out, is so easy. It syncs via iCloud, via Dropbox, Alfresco. You can also retrieve and save PDFs from Dropbox, Evernote, Box, Alfresco, and Google Drive. You can share your PDFs out to the desktop through Wi-Fi. You can transfer PDFs through iTunes, through FTP, through WebDAV. So you're going to have no trouble getting your PDFs in and out. And it now also supports those cool pressure-sensitive styluses from companies like Pogo Connect and Jot, the Jot Touch. So if you need to do annotations and mark up your PDFs, those are great tools for doing that. And that is all fully supported. So you really should go check it out. PDF Pen for iPad. Also head over to smilesoftware.com and check out all of their other great software. PDF Pen for Mac, Text Expander and Text Expander Touch, as well as Disk Label. You can get all the details and information over at smilesoftware.com. And just a huge thank you to them for their support of the MacCast. I mentioned at the top of the show that I had a little bit, that's being nice. Actually, I had quite a bit of computer trouble over this past week. And, you know, like many of us, one of the things that I had to deal with was the fact that I had a document. I received a Word document, and normally I would just open it up in iWork, but for this particular document, that just wasn't going to work out. I had to deal with Microsoft Office, and I didn't have Office. I've recently signed up for the 365 subscription because every once in a while, I just have to use the quote-unquote real thing. I have to get into Office. I had been using Office 2004. I had been Office-less for a while. I was actually pretty proud of that. But I had to go ahead and sign up and get Office 365, and that included the Office software, which happens to be Office 2011 for Mac, which was surprising to me. Well, I guess it was surprising at first, and then I realized, not that surprising that they haven't upgraded it yet, but hopefully there'll be a new version coming out. And it was fine. I was able to sign up for the software, download it, get it installed, and that was great. And then it popped up and wanted me to do an update to the latest version. It had some patches. I think it was 14.1. I can't remember the exact version number. But anyway, I needed to get 14.4.1. Needed to get updated to the latest version. Went to run the installer, and it got to saying it had about a minute left and hung at the point where it said running package scripts. And it just stuck there. Stuck there and stuck there and stuck there. I let it run as long as I thought it should have to run. I think probably 30, 40 minutes. And ended up having to force quit the installer. And that was fine. But when I went to restart my Mac, it then said the installer was still running, even though I had force quit it. So I actually ended up having to go into Activity Monitor and force quit the installd daemon. So there's a little installer daemon that runs, and I had to actually force quit that to shut it down. And so then I thought, well, you know, let me see. Maybe there's some issues with my Mac. Let me do the little voodoo dance trick and do all the little chicken waving, you know, what Merlin Man calls the chicken waving dance sort of thing, and run repair permissions and zap the pram and do all those sorts of things to figure out if I could get this thing fixed up and actually run this Office software update, right? And no matter what I did, the updater would just hang, and it would always hang. So as a last resort, I ended up calling Microsoft support. And so as much as I like to bag on Office, and I think that Office still kind of stinks and isn't all that great, I do have to share with you my Microsoft support experience, because it was stellar. It was amazing. It was not like the Microsoft that I was used to. So I called up the support line, and it wasn't very long before I actually got to a human being. Now, they were in the Philippines, and I know people sometimes feel like outsourced support is not that great. It was a little bit hard to understand this particular person, but, you know, that's not that a big a deal to me, right? So she was very, very pleasant. She spent 2 hours with me, running through very patiently all kinds of different things, including going through completely uninstalling and reinstalling my Office. They actually use LogMeIn technology to do a remote control session. So they sent me to a website, I put in some information, and they took control of my screen, and I was able to watch as they sort of, she went through and she troubleshooted all this stuff, spent all this time with me, ultimately couldn't solve my problem, but then offered to escalate it and have somebody call me back on Sunday, today, actually call me back and work through some more issues. And I got the call back today. We scheduled it for a time. They called me right on time and ultimately helped me work through the solution. Just so you know, the solution ultimately was I just had to run the OS X Mavericks combo updater. So I think something happened in my operating system at a really low level. Something got screwed up and was causing it to hang up. But we worked all through that and got it up and running, and I got my software up to date. And it was great. It was a really nice experience. It took a long time, but they were incredibly patient, incredibly helpful, incredibly nice. And I just have to give them credit where credit is due. When you have a nice support experience, it just makes the feelings about the whole company a lot better. I think this is something that Apple's known about for years. So I don't know when this change happened over at Microsoft with their support, but that is great. And if they could just get their software running better, that would be good too. And speaking of software that runs better, as I was having all this trouble, right, I had this one document that I just had to use Word for. With Office 365, you know, Apple or Microsoft has come out with their versions of Office for the iPad. So I ended up using Word on the iPad, and it was amazing. It was actually really, really good. So if you're the type of person that has to work with Word, I would really recommend trying it out on the iPad, or just Office. Try out Office on the iPad. I've been reading really good reviews about it. I had a chance to try it myself. Seems like all the features and functionality is there. It's a lot easier to use than the desktop version, in my opinion. I was able to get in there and do stuff really quick, get this document edited up and sent back. About my only complaint was that you do have to use Microsoft Drive. Is that what they call it? OneDrive or whatever their cloud storage solution is, to get files on and off, or you have to email them directly. It doesn't integrate with something like Dropbox, or there's no way to get files through Wi-Fi. I hope they change that decision at some point in the future, but you know, you can save them locally and come back and work on them. It's just you got to go through kind of a multi-step process if you want to get it into iCloud or if you want to get it into Dropbox or some other system, like email it to yourself and then move it over to Dropbox. But other than that, great job on Word for the iPad. I was actually really, really impressed. It's touch-enabled, very easy to work with. So give it a shot. You know, again, especially if you have to work with Office documents, if that's the world that you live in, then it might be worth checking out. So I was dealing with that, and that led me into, remember those rabbit holes I told you about? Today's theme? That led me to this first rabbit hole. So I mentioned that I had to force quit that Microsoft Office installer, and I had to force shut down my Mac by holding down the power button. And that opened up this big old can of worms, because on reboot, my Finder suddenly started freaking out. And I kept getting this pop-up dialog box. It said, last time you opened Finder, it unexpectedly quit while reopening Windows. Do you want to try and open its Windows again? If you choose to reopen Windows, you may have to open and position the Windows yourself. And then it had two buttons, don't reopen and reopen. And it didn't matter which one of those I would press. 30 seconds later, the exact same dialog box would pop up. And it would do it again and again and again, basically making my Mac unusable. And what I discovered is I tracked it down and figured out that it was my Transporter desktop software. Because if I would quit Transporter desktop, then that message would go away. And so I thought, well, there's a problem with Transporter desktop. Well, it turned out, rabbit hole, that it was really just a catalyst to a different issue. And what had happened was my hard shutdown had messed with something called my Dynamic Link Editor cache, or DYLD cache. What? Yeah, I know. I didn't know I had one either, and I didn't know what it was. So I thought, well, we probably should know what this is. And what happens is it can, with hard shutdowns or starting up in safe mode, which was another thing that I did during troubleshooting, it can cause problems with this Dynamic Link Editor cache. And the Dynamic Linker is a system level mechanism in OS X that OS X uses to help applications launch more quickly. So basically what it does is, you know, a bunch of your programs have shared libraries, sort of common code that they use, and it loads and links programs to these shared libraries. And most apps in OS X have these shared libraries and routines, and so that stuff can be cached. You don't have to keep loading that stuff all the time. And if something happens to that cache, then weird things like this Finder problem that I was having with the Transporter desktop can start to happen. And a corrupt Dynamic Link Editor cache can also be a cause of the spinning beach ball of death, something that plagues all of us from time to time, right? So if you're launching an application and you're seeing the spinning beach ball of death, then it could be some corruption or a problem with this Dynamic Linker. Now, luckily, there's actually a terminal command that you can run to clear out that cache, and then you can reboot your Mac and get that to rebuild. So normally, the command that you run from the command line is only run by Apple's installers or by software update. Those are kind of the official ways for the dynamic libraries, the dynamic link libraries, to get updated and rebuilt. But if you're doing a safe boot, that's when you boot up your Mac and you hold down the shift key, that cache is deleted. And I guess for some applications like Transporter Desktop, that can cause these unexpected things to happen. So if you run into the situation, the fix is to go ahead and launch the terminal and manually update that dynamic link cache. So you can run a terminal command. I'll have it in the show notes at maccast.com. But basically, you have to sudo. And if you don't know what that means, you probably don't want to be running this command manually, or you want to actually research it. But basically, up your permissions level to run update underscore DYLD underscore shared underscore cache, and then you give it a parameter of dash force. So you're forcing to update this dynamic link cache. And you'll do that. You'll be prompted to enter your admin username and password, because you have to have your, you know, upped credentials to be able to run the command. And then once you hit enter, it'll take a while for the process to run, and you don't get any feedback. So you basically just have to sit there and wait until your command prompt comes back. And then when it does, you'll know that everything happened successfully. And then after that, you do need to restart your Mac to get everything back up and running again. So it'll come back up with the updated dynamic link cache, editor cache, and you should be good to go. All should be right with the world. And that's what happened in my case. Once I restarted that, no more problems with the Transporter desktop software. And as I mentioned, this can also help sometimes with those spinning beach ball of deaths where, you know, typical fixes like the repair permissions and things like that don't work. So I wanted to point this one out just in case. And this, again, a case where going down the rabbit hole yielded some pretty interesting and helpful results. So another story that started out seeming benign and somewhat interesting and led into a pretty great discovery down another rabbit hole. And that was, I received an email from Philippe, and he was having an issue with iWork 13 and his iWork documents. Basically, what was happening was when he was saving his iWork documents, they were generating these little extra files, and he was ending up with a bunch of extra files over time in addition to the main file. And each one of these files had the same file name as the original. Then actually, they weren't files. They were folders with an interesting twist on the file name. So they had the same base file name as the original file, and then a .sb dash, and then this hashed out number at the end of the file name. So they looked like these little temporary kind of files. And in a screenshot he sent me, I noticed that all of the files were on his transporter. So transporter came back into the mix here. And I thought, well, maybe that's a factor in what's going on, why these little .sb hash files, as I'm going to call them, were being generated. And in my testing, what I noticed was that every time you save an iWork file, this little .sb hash folder would get generated automatically. Now, in the Finder, as I was watching it, so what I did was I opened up an iWork document. I left the Finder open to where that original document was, and I just started making edits and saving. And I could see this little file folder get generated, and then it would disappear. So it's sort of like a temporary file, I think, that gets generated by the application and then cleaned up. And so my theory was that what was happening in the case of the transporter is the little temporary file was getting generated, and then transporter was probably trying to sync it over to the transporter because he was working in his transporter folder. And then that was causing that file to be locked, so that when the application came back and said, okay, now clean up that little temporary folder, it probably couldn't clean it up. And so I sent a support ticket into Drobo, into transporter, and we're kind of working through that. But that's where my trip down this rabbit hole started, and it was, what the heck exactly are these .sb hash folders, and why are they created at all? And so I went looking for that, and I actually didn't find the answer to that. So if anybody knows what these little folders are, it looked like what was in there is probably like some of the metadata that gets saved with the file, but that's just a sort of wild guess at this point. But I didn't figure out what those were, but I found something else that was even more interesting. And it had to do with the iWork file format. So in iWork 13, Apple significantly changed the document format of iWork files. And what that meant for a lot of us was that when you open up an older, say, iWork 09 file, it's going to ask you to convert to the new file format. And if you need to send a file back to somebody who's on iWork 09, right, you have to go in and you have to specifically export that format. So you don't have that sort of just straight compatibility from the old version to the new version. And so there was a lot of question and a lot of people asking, well, why is this? Why did Apple so significantly change the file format? What was sort of the reason? And it turns out that there was actually a pretty good reason for it. And it was that we had iWork on the Mac desktop, and then we had iWork on iOS. And if you remember, when Apple brought out iWork for iPad, migrating files back and forth from iWork 09 on the Mac desktop to your iOS device was a really tricky proposition. It required some tricky behind-the-scenes conversions of the actual file format. Now, you and I, as users, didn't really know this, but people investigated and went and looked under the hood and thought, you know, why is this process so convoluted? Why can't I just take the file from my iPad and move it on to my Mac and just have it all work together? Now, Apple was having to do some things to get the file formats to work together. And if you went and digging through the package contents of, say, a Pages document, what you would find was that it had a bunch of XML files in there. And you can actually go in and you can read those XML files and in just like your favorite text editor and kind of see what was going on. Underneath all those layers of the file format, it was really just these property list files, these XML files, and you know, a few other things kind of making the file format work. And they were all really human readable. You could kind of figure out what was going on with your documents if you inspected all these things. Well, then comes along iWork 13, and Apple changed everything so that the file format on the Mac and iOS was exactly the same. It could be consistent, meaning that you could take the same files that were on your Mac, move them over to your iPad, and there wasn't any kind of underlying changing back and forth. So with 09 in the older version of the iPad documents, Apple actually had to slightly manipulate things in the background. And once again, we didn't really see this, but we kind of had some of the disadvantages of moving back and forth. But in order to fix things up for iWork 13, they had to make some significant under the hood changes. And so some people have done some digging, and now inside, say, a Pages package file, what you're going to see is you're going to see a data folder, an index.zip folder, a metadata folder, and then some JPEG preview files. And so the question became, well, why all of these changes? Why did Apple kind of do this? And what appears to have happened is they split things up into, from being that sort of one large XML document file, and now what's stored in specifically that index.zip archive is a bunch of smaller binary files. And the reason you would want to do this is that the smaller files can all be loaded one at a time, which is much more useful on, say, an iOS device where you might have limited resources or limited memory. So, for example, in a Keynote document now, each page is a separate binary file, or each slide is a separate binary file. I would imagine in Pages, probably each page is a little separate binary file. And binary as a format, rather than just like a straight XML human readable text format, because the binary files can be smaller, they can be faster to load, and also faster to sync. And then another thing is that syncing is also much easier if you have a bunch of smaller files, because if you make a change in one file, you can just sync up that single file rather than having to do the entire large XML file every time. So in extracting that index.zip, that's exactly what you see, this collection of .iwa files or iWork archive files. And what those appear to be is this binary format, no longer human readable XML. And what they really are, if you do even more digging, if you go deeper into the rabbit hole, is that they're these serialized files that are in a custom format consisting of what's called a protobuffer stream. And those are wrapped in something called a snappy stream, which is some compression. And I got all this information by doing some searching online. I'll have a link to it in the show notes at macast.com, but there's a really good GitHub page from a guy named Sean Patrick O'Brien that explains a lot of this serialization and these different file formats. It basically breaks down the entire iWork document and lets you know what all these component pieces are. But here's the thing, right? These protocol buffers and Snappy, this Snappy compression technology, these are Google technologies. So protocol buffers and Snappy. And according to Google, what a protocol buffer is it's a flexible and efficient way, an automated mechanism for serializing structured data. So like XML, but think smaller, faster, and simpler. And Google actually uses protocol buffers as a consistent means of storage for a lot of their data. And that means that very likely the same format that Google Docs are stored in on Google servers, it's very probably similar to the way that Apple is storing your iWork documents on your Mac. And the Snappy compression format is something else that Google created, and it's aimed at giving compression at really high speed ratios. And these IWA files are stored in this Snappy framing format, although they don't necessarily adhere to the real strict spec. So I guess protocol buffers and Snappy are probably open source technologies that Google has. I should have dug into that a little bit more. I assume they're open source technologies. You can get all the information and details on it over at Google's website. And again, I'll have links to those in the show notes at maccast.com if you really want to get into the nitty-gritty of all of this. But it is a funny choice for Apple to make, because they tell developers that for their file-based document, you know, file-based apps, they should be using Core Data basically as the document format. And Apple's own Core Data technology is already pretty compact. It supports partial loading and allows for syncing to cloud storage, say like iCloud, and it's in an open SQLite format. So it really does get you thinking, you know, why would Apple themselves opt for a different binary format that incorporates a lot of Google technology rather than their own Core Data technology? And the only thing I can come to a conclusion with, and some others from some of the stuff I was reading as well kind of had the same conclusion, was that probably the cloud has a lot to do with it. Google is very good at the cloud, and these Google technologies were very optimized for cloud storage. And we've heard a lot of reports that developers have had a hard go with Core Data and iCloud syncing. So maybe Apple knew that as well and said, we're not going to use that technology for iWork. We're going to actually use these other technologies. So very, very interesting to find out how sort of iWork formats, file formats work, especially in iWork 13. And so I guess that inevitably leads to the question of, you know, why do we even care at all about file formats? This is kind of a more, led me into this thought process and this more general idea of file formats. And why is this a big deal? You know, why would it be a big deal that Apple went from kind of an open human readable XML file format into this more proprietary kind of binary format? And again, after doing all the digging, it's not really all that proprietary. There's a lot of, you know, open technologies in there. But, you know, why is this a big deal? And really, it comes down to portability and I think non-obsolescence of your data being two big reasons. I get email all the time from people who are asking me, hey, I've got a bunch of old WordPerfect files, or I've got a bunch of old AppleWorks files, and I'd really like to open them. They have data and information in them that I'd like to get at. And that's really hard to do with these kind of closed proprietary formats. If that was all, say, just in an open format, like a text file, something like that, then we'd have no problems. And so there's a couple different ways that you can deal with file formats and making sure that you're going to be able to get at your data in the future, making sure that they're open to you. And one way is to make sure that you export your documents or save your documents that are in more proprietary systems or more closed systems as open formats. Kind of, you know, you generate two versions. So if you're working in Word or Pages, maybe you want to also save out a copy as a rich text format document or a PDF. Or if you're working with images, you might want to make sure that you have a copy that's in just JPEG format rather than, say, just purely a layered Photoshop file. Or if you're working with a spreadsheet, save out a CSV, a comma separated value, or a tab delineated format. Or maybe you want to save out a text version. If you're working with audio, you want to have maybe an MP3 version. And, you know, some formats are more open than others, and I'm using that term open very loosely, more to say in a format that you can be reasonably sure is going to be around a lot longer than, say, the original proprietary format, right? So all of my examples are not necessarily going to be things that I think are going to be around forever, but they are more universal than, say, a proprietary format that might be tied to a single app. And so the biggest concern here is having the ability to, you know, export the file when you need it into a new format. You don't want to wait until your program no longer runs on your Mac, because you're not going to be able to export it. And that's something that hit a lot of people, say, with AppleWorks or WordPerfect, those examples I was using earlier. So the sooner you can do it, the better. The other way, though, that you can sort of avoid file obsolescence, I think, is to maybe change your workflow a little bit and start with a workflow that begins in the more open format and then migrate it or move it through the workflow toward a more proprietary format if that's your ultimate destination. And this is something I kind of learned from David Sparks, Mac Sparky, over at Mac Power Users. He's really gotten into this in, I think, a pretty big way in a lot of his workflows. And so, say, I'm just going to use the example of a Pages document or some sort of text document. I now almost start everything as a Markdown file, which is really just a text format, a straight-up text format. And then I can take those documents and I can take that data and information and progress it into Microsoft Word or Pages, or some, in some cases, it'll end up in Omni Outliner, say, if I'm doing some show prep. So I'll start doing the show notes in just a text file, bulleted list, that sort of thing, and then migrate that up into a more proprietary format. And this actually feels a lot more like what I do in my programming, right? We start in programming in general. We start with some sort of source code and then ultimately compile it down into some sort of binary or more proprietary sort of closed format. But the deal is that the original source material is always portable, right? It can be read, it can be converted into another language or some other system because it's much more open. So either way that you do these things, it's probably important to keep a backup of both the more open file format and the proprietary versions of the files, because that's a whole nother thing, right? The bit rot and making sure that, you know, your backups don't go bad and you have these files. And we've talked about some of that stuff in the past too, about, you know, conversion or format shifting as time and technologies change and things like that. And that's another whole part of this. But really, you know, just this whole thing that I went through this week got me thinking about these file formats and trying to make sure that, hey, yeah, I want to have workflows and I want to have file formats that are going to be portable and they're going to be, you know, have some sort of longevity, and I'll be able to take my data along with me and all those sorts of things. So I wanted to just kind of share those thoughts and that information with you. And then kind of the one of the last things that I ran into as I was going through this whole process and I had my crazy week was that at one point I needed to restore some files from Time Machine. I had been doing some things, I had made some changes and overwritten some stuff and realized, you know what, I want to go back and I want to get an older copy of something that I, you know, I don't have. And I thought, oh, great, well, I have Time Machine, right? I'll just go into Time Machine, I'll flick on Time Machine, go into that crazy space view, and go back and restore this certain folder that I wanted to get at. And so I did that, I activated Time Machine, and I browsed back, and sure enough, there was the version that I wanted to get. I went to select it and click it in Time Machine and realized I couldn't select it. And I thought, well, that was odd, and then I noticed that the restore button wasn't clickable. And I thought, oh, that's really weird. I've always been able to do this in the past. But what I hadn't done is I had not tried Time Machine after upgrading to Mavericks. And so I immediately thought, well, there's some sort of Mavericks issue here. And I did a little bit of Googling and I discovered that there's actually a known issue in Mavericks. It's been around in a while and it's not patched in 10.9.2, where if you're like me and you use a second monitor, that Time Machine will not let you restore your files. Even though you can go back and you can browse, you can't restore your files. And it only seems to impact people that are using Mission Control and Spaces in the Displays Have Separate Spaces mode. So that's the option that was made available in Mavericks, where you can have full screen apps on each screen. If you have that turned on, you might run into this problem. So I wanted to point it out because it was really obscure and took me a little bit of time to figure out what was going on. Luckily, the workarounds are pretty straightforward and simple. So for my situation, what I ended up doing was simply mirroring my display temporarily. So I went into System Preferences, went into Displays, clicked on the Arrangement tab, and then there's a little checkbox that says Mirror Displays. I checked that on, then went into Time Machine, went back and found that folder that I wanted to restore, and I was able to just select it, restore it just as I normally would with Time Machine. No problems at all. The only weird thing was that I had to have my displays being mirrored. Another option that you could do would be to simply just disconnect the second display. So I could have just unplugged the Thunderbolt port, you know, the Thunderbolt cable, and that is reported to work. Something else people have reported having success in using as a workaround would be to go into Mission Control and disable the displays have separate spaces option. The only bummer with that one is that it requires that you log out and log back in for the change to take effect. So I don't think it's quite as convenient, but many people have reported that working. And then some people have also said that if you just make sure that the Finder is on your main display before activating Time Machine, that that'll work to kind of work around the issue. I did try that as my first fix, and that did not work in my case. So you may have mixed results with that one. But as far as why it's happening, my best guess, because it wasn't really clear, but my best guess was that that new feature in Mavericks of having displays as separate spaces, that might be the problem, because Time Machine has always operated in that kind of single screen, full screen mode. So when you activate Time Machine, your one screen goes full screen and the other screen kind of goes blank. And it still does that under Mavericks, even though Mavericks has this new feature where you can have two apps up full screen. So my guess is that Time Machine is still operating in that kind of one screen mode. And if you have dual screen mode kind of enabled, that freaks it out a little bit, but I don't really know on that. I'm just hoping that Apple fixes this bug soon, because it's a really odd one, and I wanted to point it out just in case some of you might run into that yourselves, and now you'll know how to fix it. But with that, that is going to do it for the MacCast for this week. Before I leave you, I do want to take a quick moment and thank all of my show sponsors. Smile, makers of Text Expander, PDF Pen, Disc Label, also PDF Pen for iPad, as well as Text Expander Touch and PDF Pen Scan Plus for your iOS devices. You can check out all their software, get more information and details over at smilesoftware.com. And Gazelle. Gazelle is the fast and simple way to sell your used gadgets. You can find out what your used iPhone, iPad, or other Apple products are worth over at gazelle.com. Big thank you to all of my sponsors for their support of the MacCast. A big thank you to you for your support, for listening, for staying subscribed. If you have any feedback for me, comment, a question, something you'd like to hear covered on a MacCast, you can shoot me email. My email rather is maccast@gmail.com. You can also call in on the listener hotline and leave a voicemail. The number is 281-622-4269. 281-MAC-IAM-9. And if you need show notes, links to anything that I talked about on this or any other episode of the MacCast, you can find those on the MacCast website. That's at maccast.com. And while you're there, be sure to check out the forum at forum.maccast.com. And if you'd like to follow me online, I'm on Twitter, twitter.com/MacCast. You can check out the Facebook page over at facebook.com/TheMacCast. And you can also find MacCast on Google Plus. There's a Google Plus community. Just search for MacCast on Google Plus and you should be able to find it. And I look forward to seeing you online. But that's going to do it for now. Until next time, I will talk to you all again real soon.